This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Hospital patients, soldiers, and prisoners started voting in Iraq today. In theory, that includes Saddam Hussein. Tomorrow, balloting begins for Iraqis overseas. There are polling stations in 15 countries, including the U.S. Then on Thursday, Iraqis vote to elect 275 members of parliament. After interim and transitional governance, this new parliament will sit for 4 years under the terms of the constitution that was ratified in a nationwide referendum earlier this fall. We'll take a look at the leading candidates, the issues facing the country, and at divisions among Shias, Sunnis, and Kurds. Later in the program, Kanan Makia is on the Talk of the Nation opinion page. Yesterday, the Iraqi writer published a long op-ed piece in the Sunday New York Times where he argued that the weak central government established in the Constitution will make the new government in Baghdad even more dysfunctional and could lay the groundwork for a bloody civil war. If you'd like to read the piece, there's a link to it on the Talk of the Nation page at npr.org. But first, a look at the candidates and the circumstances of Iraq's elections. If you have questions about who's on the ballot, what's at stake, or about the extraordinary security that will be in effect this week, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. We'll go to Baghdad a bit later, but we begin here in Studio 3A with Phoebe Marr, the author of The Modern History of Iraq, also a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And thanks very much for joining us today.
Well, it's my pleasure.
This is Iraq's third election this past year. This is for the National Parliament, correct?
Yes, that's right, the National Assembly.
And is this organized along, how is it organized? Is there an equivalent of a Senate, or what goes on here?
Well, the Constitution lays out some regulations, but in fact it left a lot of holes, and this new parliament is going to have to fill them in. But there will be a presidency consisting of a president and two vice presidents, essentially to accommodate the three main ethnic and sectarian communities.
So in this current transitional government, there's a Kurd who's the president, and then two vice presidents, one of whom is a Shia and one of whom is a Sunni.
That is correct. Now, whether that same arrangement will continue, we don't know. But the assembly must by two-thirds elect this presidency as a package. Although this is not a strong presidential government, quite the contrary. It's going to be a parliamentary government with a prime minister, and the prime minister is supposed to be picked from the majority, but we don't expect a single majority. There, we can sketch in the parties, but it's certainly going to have to be, most likely going to have to be, some kind of a coalition, and then it will form a government which has to maintain the confidence of parliament. So there's a parliamentary government, but this is so-called for keeps, because, as you said, the previous governments have been transitional. Everybody knows that they're going to be out of office very, very shortly. So this is definitely going to set the direction of the country for some considerable time.
And as opposed to the system we have in this country, where the president names a cabinet of various individuals, in Iraq, the key person will be the prime minister, who is a member of parliament, will be elected by the parliament, and will name other members of parliament as oil minister, interior minister, minister of defense, those sorts of things.
Yeah, that's correct. The president must select the prime minister, but it will be from probably the party that get the largest vote. This is going to be essentially a parliamentary system, more like the European kind, something like Britain rather than the United States.
And again, now let's look at the major parties. In the previous elections, Shia Alliance basically got the lion's share of the votes, reflecting the fact that I guess Shias are the largest ethnic sectarian group in the country.
Well, in fact, if you look at the major parties, it's not simply parties, but it's alliances, groups of parties, which I can sketch out for you. Many of them are the same, although there are probably going to be a couple of differences in this election. As you say, the main party is the United Iraqi Alliance. They don't call themselves the Shia Alliance, although that is essentially what they are, consisting of three major parties, so-called SCIRI by its initials, the, what is it, Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. It is a religious party. The second element of that is the Da'wah party. And a third element, which is coming up in importance, are the Sadrists, followers of Muqtada Sadr. There are other individuals and groups in that alliance, but that's probably the one of the key groups. It got a slight majority of seats in parliament last time. It is not expected to get a majority this time because they're going to be Sunnis that are voting.
Mm-hmm. Now, that party last time had the explicit endorsement of Ayatollah Ali Sistani, the leading Shia cleric in the country.
That is correct, and there's been a lot of talk this time. In fact, the clerics said that everybody should vote, but they decided to stay out of endorsing a party. Recently, there have been some reports that Ayatollah Sistani may have come out and said yes, but don't vote for a weak party, don't vote for a non-religious party. It's not exactly clear what he said, but certainly the party, certainly the people who are running with a wink and a nod would like people to believe that they have religious authority. And to be frank about it, it's quite likely that a number of Shia are going to vote for that party because they're voting as Shia.
Mm-hmm. Then there is a the two big Kurdish parties, the Kurdistan Democratic Party, run by the Barzani family, as dominated by the Barzani family, and the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. The current president of Iraq, Mr. Talabani, leads the PUK.
Yes, that's the Kurdish Gathering, I think they're calling it this time. They are the backbone, of course, of the Kurdish ticket. There are some smaller groups. They always include some Turkmen, some Christian members of their party. The interesting thing in the north this time is that one Kurdish party, the Kurdish, I think it's the Kurdish Islamic Union, which is a moderate Islamist group, broke away and is running separately. That's caused a little angst up there, but essentially the Kurds are expected to have a good showing, but not as good as they did last time. The third group, I would say, to watch in this is a group that I like to call centrist. This is the group that Ayad Alawi is heading.
The former interim prime minister.
The former interim prime minister. He's calling his ticket the Iraqi list, which gives you the idea of its direction. It's a little more Iraqi nationalist. It's much more secularist, and it is not in favor of ethnic and sectarian voting. He got about 14% of the votes last time, and it's going to be interesting to see whether, in fact, that party can increase its votes on the basis of sort of secular, party-oriented votes rather than ethnic and sectarian votes.
And then there's the other group. In a speech earlier today at the World Affairs Council in Philadelphia, President Bush, this is, I guess, the third of his series of speeches on the future of the U.S. policy in Iraq. The president, talking about specifically about politics, said that Iraq's Sunnis largely sat out the election for the transitional government back in January. He says that's not going to happen this time around.
More Sunnis are involved because they see Iraqi democracy succeeding. They have learned a lesson of democracy. They must participate to have a voice in their nation's affairs. A leading Sunni who had boycotted the January vote put it this way: the Sunnis are now ready to participate. A Sunni sheikh explains why Sunnis must join the process. In order not to be marginalized, we need power in the National Assembly. As more Sunnis join the political process, the Saddamists and remaining rejectionists will be marginalized. As more Sunnis join the political process, they will protect the interests of their community.
I think something like 5% of Sunnis, eligible Sunnis, voted in January. And Phoebe Marr, I think that's expected to be quite a bit higher this time around.
I think it was more than that, but whatever. It was very few, absolutely.
5% in Anbar province.
In Anbar province, and there were more. But you're quite right. Many of them sat it out. They were not organized. They didn't have any particular political parties. And this time, the split in the community is clear. That's a good thing because it is marginalizing extremists, people who want to boycott, some of the terrorists there beyond the pale. Probably not all of the rejectionists are going to come in this time, but I think it's very clear that they've learned their lesson and they want to be part of the process. There are a couple of alliances that have been formed. One of them leans a little in the religious direction. The Iraqi Islamic Party, for example, is in that group. And then there's one that's a little bit more secular. But there are at least two fairly strong Sunni coalitions, as well as Sunnis running on the Alawi ticket. So I think it's quite correct. There will be Sunnis in the assembly, and how many will be interesting to watch, how strong and how united they are and how well they advocate the interests of their community will be a very critical issue in reducing the insurgency and in moving this government forward.
If you have questions about what's at stake, who's on the ballot, give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email totn@npr.org. And Chuck is on the line from San Francisco.
Thanks very much.
Sure.
I've read in the papers that most of the people in Iraq don't really know much in the way of particulars about the parties or the candidates in terms of their actual positions on various issues and even what a lot of the issues might be. And it seems like there ought to be something we could do about that, and maybe something we should have done about that, because it just seems to me that in the absence of that, what you get is what seems to be the situation that pertains now, which is people voting along religious and sectarian lines, which just would seem to sort of exacerbate the sort of tensions in the country there, as opposed to moving them further along towards an actual functional democracy like we know it, where mm-hmm. You have politicians who are somewhat known quantities with somewhat known positions on a set of issues that people have opinions and discourse about.
Well, we've just got a few seconds left, but Phoebe Marr, can you give Chuck at least partly an answer? We'll get back to the rest of it after we come back from the break.
There's been a very lively campaign, much more advertising. We are doing something about it. There are several organizations the United States has in there helping people understand how to run campaigns and teaching them, and that has definitely shown up in the newspaper ads and elsewhere. But once you introduce democracy, you can't prevent people from voting on what they want. Kurds may vote for Kurds, and Shia may vote for a more religious ticket.
Chuck, this is an issue that's going to continue to come up throughout the show, so I'm sure we're going to get to the other aspects of your question. But thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
We're going to continue to preview the Iraqi elections after a short break. We're going to also be joined by a reporter from Baghdad to see what the situation feels like there. And a bit later in the show, we'll talk with Kanan Makia, president of the Iraq Memory Foundation, about why he thinks the Iraqi constitution needs a rewrite. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing the upcoming elections in Iraq with Phoebe Marr, a senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace. You're invited, of course, to join us. If you have questions about what's likely to happen, what's at stake, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from Baghdad is Michael Ware, Time Magazine's Baghdad bureau chief, and it's nice of you to be with us this evening.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Just to follow up on Chuck's question just before the break, in terms of what the election looks like, do the campaign posters say, vote for me, we'll fix the streets, we'll give you electricity, or does it say, vote for me because all religious Shias should stick together?
Well, there's a lot of messages being cast in the sea of posters that have Baghdad awash. Some of them intone images of security. Some of them portray the candidates with a sense of the strong man who can deliver. Some of them are rich with religious iconography, and I believe from my translators that one of them actually says, vote for me and every Iraqi will have a house built for them. I'm not sure how many people really believe that.
In this country you call that a chicken in every pot speech.
Yeah, it's the ultimate pork barrel.
And in terms of these, are there a lot of ads on TV and the newspapers as well?
Yes, I mean, this is a very lively electoral environment. I mean, there is a great debate after a fall of Saddam's regime. We saw the birth of a plethora of media outlets, TV, radio, and newspaper, all representing markedly different interests. Some of them actually, you know, supported and funded by various militias, by other countries, by intelligence agencies. Some of them appear for a few months and then disappear, not to be seen again. But it really is a very lively debate here within the public domain.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Laurie, and Laurie's calling us from Wichita in Kansas.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could comment on how the upcoming election will serve to help stabilize that region. I mean, it's one thing for the United States to talk about withdrawal versus no withdrawal versus the staged withdrawal, but the people who live in that country and who live in that region don't have the opportunity to withdraw from the insurgent violence.
Michael Ware, let's hear from you on that, and then we'll ask Phoebe Marr the same question.
Well, perhaps I'm not the best person to ask. I mean, unfortunately, I'm of the view that the election processes that we have seen so far and that we're about to witness again in a few days have come at a time and have been constructed in such a manner that, quite frankly, they promise to further sow the seeds of division rather than unite this country. I think that there is going to be a legacy from this electoral process that is going to be borne by the Iraqi people and is going to be felt across the region and in terms of the US mission for a long time to come. Indeed, America's greatest political ally in this country, former Prime Minister Iyad Alawi himself, to me just a couple of weeks ago, said on the record that we have rushed into democracy, that things are not going well, and that the interests that are being served by the political process at the moment are the religious extremes on both sides. So he sees that at the moment, Iraq is set on a very, very dangerous course that the electoral process is not serving.
Phoebe Marr, would you agree?
Not entirely, although there is a great deal of truth in that. One of the big issues, perhaps the big issue in this campaign, is whether Iraq will stay together or whether not only sectarian but ethnic identity will pull it apart. Iyad Alawi, of course, represents this trend that I talked about, the Iraqi first trend, and the fact that he probably isn't going to get as many votes as many people would like causes him to say that. But let me address the caller's issue this way. One thing that will come out of this election is Sunni participation in parliament. If Sunnis get into the government, that is to say, they form a portion of the government and they can get some of Sunni grievances satisfied, they may, in fact, gradually help damp down the insurgency. We shouldn't expect that to happen automatically or overnight, but it is one positive element that could come out of this campaign.
Laurie, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Today's Washington Post and New York Times reported that another Iraqi government detention center has been raided where 600 prisoners were found, 13 of them in such bad condition that they needed medical treatment. This is the second time in this case, you have to say it's the Iraqi Interior Ministry, but it's run by Shias primarily, and that these are mostly Sunni prisoners.
Absolutely. This is a part, yet again, of where we can see the undeclared civil war that is already underway once night falls in Iraq. I mean, there are rival death squads that roam the streets every night. Now, the Shia currently control the organs of government. That includes the Ministry of Interior, which U.S. Ambassador Khalilzad said is essentially within the control of Iranian interests. This is in the control of the militia, the Badr militia, which was created by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and continues to receive their support. So the Shia death squads, the Shia militants who are attacking the Sunni community are doing so in uniforms. And they have been doing this all year. This has been documented several times. There are more prisons yet to be uncovered. And U.S. diplomats have known about this. I and other journalists spoke to diplomats about these hidden torture centers 6 months ago. It's only now that we see the U.S. putting pressure on this government and raiding some of these centers in the last dying gasps of the government.
All right, let's get another caller on the line, and this is John, and John's calling us from, Trevor City in Michigan.
Hello.
Hi, Traverse City, Michigan, yes.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air, John. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I'd like to ask your guests if they know how involved the U.S. Embassy is, which is one of the largest in the world, and or U.S. tax money in the election, whether it be in the campaigns or otherwise.
Phoebe Marr, you were talking about the U.S. providing funds to teach some of the elements of democracy. Is the U.S. providing funds for candidates?
I really don't know the answer to that question. Of course, the answer should be that it should be a free and fair election. The United States government should not be funding candidates. The people who are doing the teaching are perfectly legitimate. They are funded by the taxpayers. International Republican Institute and the National Democratic Institute's job is to help people develop democracy. They're perfectly open, and their services are open to every single candidate and group that wants to take it in Iraq, and so one shouldn't be concerned about that.
Well, the U.S. favorite, Mr. Alawi, if you will, I mean, I guess he's the Washington's candidate, if there is one. Is he getting support from the embassy, do we know?
I have no idea. Technically speaking, he shouldn't be, but I'm not in any position whatever to know whether there's anything going on there or not. There shouldn't be.
Michael Ware, are you aware of anything like that?
Well, there's nothing that one can put one's finger on right now, but this has certainly been a cause of great complaint by Mr. Alawi and others who see that their political agendas align with the United States and that as allies, they have been abandoned, left dangling in the breeze as they were during the January 30 elections. I mean, the reality is that other countries who have their allies or indeed their proxies here in Iraq have not been hands-off. And they have pumped millions of dollars into the electoral process. And you'll find that election posters and election advertisements are put together outside of Iraq and enter the country and are then distributed or aired. So in one sense, there's been some complaint from America's political and intelligence allies in this country saying that, you know, you do not support your friends, yet you create a process that you allow to be manipulated by your enemies who then capitalize on this and leave all of us in the lurch and American interests floundering.
John, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
And just before we let you go, Michael Ware, we know that there are going to be extraordinary security measures in place across the country come Election Day. Are you seeing any evidence of that already?
Oh, absolutely. There are troops that have taken up positions within the streets. We're seeing traffic very much going from overflow within this busy metropolis to almost a trickle, and soon it will vanish altogether. I mean, to have an election in the midst of such an intense war zone, you need the entire country to go into lockdown. So this is a period of great anxiety, even though it's known that the Sunnis are going to vote en masse, even though the insurgents, the nationalist insurgents, the Ba'athists and the Iraqi Islamists have declared that they will not attack this election. And even though that they say that they will be able to contain the terrorist forces of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and his al-Qaeda organization, there is still great apprehension in the air as security forces move into place for the election day itself.
Michael Ware, appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for being with us. And Phoebe Marr,
my pleasure.
Appreciate it. Phoebe Marr, if there's one thing that you anticipate from this election, what would that be? Do you think there will be a strong government that can emerge?
Now, not a strong government, no. I think what I would anticipate is considerable participation. It's a real election with different parties, but there's going to have to be a lot of haggling and bargaining between and among these groups to get some kind of coalition, and we're going to have some patience because this is going to take time. And this urge for the strong man, the figure who can lead Iraq, this is an illusion. It is not going to happen. It's going to be a slow, gradual process, and I think Americans have to understand the time and the fact that it's going to be gradual. It isn't going to happen overnight, but I do see some progress and a little bit more hope than it sounds like from Baghdad, because I think we have to remember that Baghdad doesn't reflect the whole country. The Kurdish area is more stable. The south is not as stable as the Kurds, but the Baghdad scene, and I know it, is very tense, and that reflects a lot of this anxiety there.
And indeed, the situation, again, in Anbar province to the west of the heart of the Sunni areas, that's also pretty tense.
Yes, that's absolutely.
Fallujah, Ramadi, that sort of thing. Phoebe Marr, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Phoebe Marr, a senior fellow with the U.S. Institute of Peace and author of The Modern History of Iraq, and she was kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.